de un apartamento Volga infestado y en los livings de un hombre encantador. It's Bat Segundo!
Yes, Jorge, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed for that enthusiasm. It's always very helpful, kids, to get a little bit of Spanish in your ear after a night of lots of drinks, loose women, and, of course, an empty wallet. Well, you all know the drill. Sometimes you eat the bar, and sometimes the bar eats you. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, flying underneath the literary radar with a new show. We have an intrepid interviewer who goes out there and talks with authors, some important, some not so important. But in this case, I think we can all concur that he may be an important one. This particular author is David Mitchell, recent author of Cloud Atlas, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, as well as Number 9 Dream, which resembled one of my hangovers near the end, but it was still good stuff, and Ghost Ridden, which was highly acknowledged as one of the greatest UK debuts, perhaps, since Martin Amis and the Rachel Papers. Well, kids, you make the call. Anyway, we talked with Mr. Mitchell, who was a very kind and polite man and put up with our intrepid interviewer's little fanboyish nature. We'll have to get that man fixed, if you know what I mean. Anyway, kids, enjoy the interview and enjoy the show.
You need 5 minutes to sort of get sort of acclimated, and should I call you back, or?
That's really considerate of you, but I've just spent about 3 minutes getting acclimated, and I'm fine and ready to go, full of energy and ready to sound witty, casual, and confident.
Okay. First off, I wanted to thank you very much for this interview, and also thank you very much. I really much enjoyed your book.
My pleasure, Edward. I can't hear that often enough. Thank you very much
indeed. Well, hey, yeah, I've read all three of the books, and I'm incredibly impressed with your talent, and it's just been an absolute pleasure to really sort of sift through your puzzle box narratives. And I do want to say that first off, you know, of course you've heard that endlessly, I'm sure. But no amount of praise is good enough.
Well, I'm very grateful. Thank you very much. And it's really impressive that you do so much research for your interviewees, because as you may know, it tends not to be the norm in North America. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I know it's been a mystery to me too. I have a couple of questions here. I guess we could start out with. First off, my question to you, and this again, sort of getting into what we were just talking about North American reviewers, is how would you answer critics who I'm not going to name any particular names, but how would you answer the ones who would claim that your book is unreadable?
In a non-conceited way, I'm not sure if I would answer them. If that's someone's honest opinion, and if it's coming from a position of integrity, then it's simply I can't accuse them of being wrong. I can't accuse them of being disingenuous. If it's really what they feel, then I regret it. But so be it. That's kind of my answer to the question, really. I'm happy enough that I hear from enough readers and some reviewers who think that the book is readable. So if some individuals feel it isn't readable, then I wish them happiness and a long life. hope that they find some more readable books soon.
Well, you could always give them William Faulkner's answer, and that was, read it 4 times.
I will store that away for the next time.
Okay. Well, I also wanted to talk about the motifs that appear in your books. I noticed that there are a lot of things, islands in particular. You're very interested in islands, whether it's Clear Island in Ghost Ridden, the island where E.G. is in Number 9 Dream, and, of course, the infamous islands in Cloud Atlas. And I read John Walsh's profile in The Independent, and apparently your fourth book has a man-made island of Dejima. And I'm curious as to why you seem to think, why you're attracted to islands.
That's a really good one. Really good question, Edward. By the time you get to your fourth book, you notice these kind of themes or motifs. Perhaps they are theme-tiefs. where a theme and a motif overlaps. But you notice these things, they keep rearing their heads, and it's not really because you're consciously putting them in book after book after book, but there must be another group of me's that are inside me who make themselves manifest when I write, in the same way that we have the common experience of other parts of ourselves making themselves manifest when we dream. Why? You'd sort of need to ask the psychiatrist that I do not have that question, I think. Longing for... Actually, if you just hold the line a moment, I did a short piece for a Dutch film crew who were over in Ireland doing a really short documentary on me earlier in the year, and in this very notebook, I did write, I think, a short piece about this. Islands. Is it okay if I just dictate this over the phone? It's about 12 lines long, I think. But it does answer your question.
That's perfectly fine, yes.
Here we go. Islands keep cropping up in my work. I can count 10 in my first 3 novels, and the novel I want to start on this year will be based entirely on Dejima at the Dutch East Indies Company outpost at Nagasaki. My earliest books were actually maps of imaginary continents. Obviously not literally books, but that's sort of how I... When I look back at my childhood forms of play, I think the part of my brain that now writes novels, that's how it was occupied when I was, say, 11 years old or something. But my earliest books were actually maps of imaginary continents. My parents were artists, so there were always big sheets of cartridge paper around the house. Just one sheet would keep me happy for hours and hours as I invented archipelagos, topologies, and...
Archipelagos?
And toponymies, sure. I'm almost through. Islands are perhaps the geological expression most similar to novels. They're both protected from and cut off from mainland reality. They often have their own customs, dialects, flora, fauna, a limited cast of characters, and the pubs have their own licensing hours, by which I mean they have their own laws. The past tends to be more visible on islands. Family roots tend to be deeper and more bound up in the landscape because it costs too much to cart away heavy rubbish, discarded tractors, dead TVs and so forth. It just tends to be left to decompose gently in the elements, reminding everyone what and whose it once was, like public memento moris. Lastly, it's no accident that utopias and paradises are usually set on islands. That's kind of what I had to say then, and I still kind of stand by that. It doesn't quite answer your question, but it sort of hedges around it a bit.
Well, definitely gets close to there. That's good. The other question I had from you is that the influence of the Bridge of San Luis Rey upon your work. First of all, you have a character named Luisa Rey.
Spot it.
Yes. You have an accident on a bridge. You have, I believe, the Duchess shows up in the Slusha's portion of Cloud Atlas. And you open up with a quote from Bridge of San Luis Rey at the beginning of Ghost Written. So I'm curious if you could sort of talk about how much the Bridge of San Luis Rey means to you, and why it sort of keeps popping up in your work.
I'm not sure there's that much to say. I admire it enormously. It's a fine, fine, fine piece of work. I think it's also a little bit like a... Lem Stanev's Lov's Solaris, in that it's a piece of work that 10 different filmmakers could make 10 different films of, and they would all be pretty different. It's simply, I think, a flawless metaphor and investigation of fate and chance and their interplay. And this is an absorbing aspect of the human condition. It doesn't just fascinate me, it fascinates people, period. And Thornton Wilder did this theme to perfection in the bridge of San Luis Rey. Is that sort of enough for you? It's apart from gushing admiration, I kind of don't have that much to say on it, really. But it's just a beautiful piece of work, and I can't really resist paying homage to it in my work.
Gotcha. Well, that's no problem there. The other question I had, a number of them actually, I wanted to actually talk about your use of language. For example, the use of corporations as verbs in the Somni 451 section, the dropping of the letter E, the highly stylized language of Slusha. Where do these language exercises come from? Do you often find yourself sort of overwhelmed by your own sort of imagination?
There are two questions there. I'll do the second one first. I would like to be as overwhelmed as possible by my imagination as often as possible. The first question's longer. The different dialects in Cloud Atlas, they are there because I wanted one of the themes of the novel to be the continental drift of language over time. How one generation's respectable English, or any other language, but since we're in English, I'll keep it to that. How one generation's respectable English becomes the next generation's set of archaicisms. Mm-hmm. Neologisms in one generation become the next generation's normal speech. I love this. It's great how you can go around the country the size of the United States and just get a plethora of different versions of purportedly the same language. I also have a page in my notebook especially for Americanisms, and it's been one of my busiest pages over the last few days. So given that that was one of my themes, it simply made most sense to write the novellas in a contemporaneous form of English. So really, this was dictated by the theme. I'm fascinated by language. That sounds an obvious thing to say, but in a way now that I wasn't when I wrote my first two books, when I was a younger writer and a less mature one, language was just something I didn't really think consciously that much about. But now I've, partly thanks to and during the writing of Cloud Atlas, I've come to understand now more how language is this holy, sacred, almost mystical thing that we use all the time and therefore take for granted. It's miraculous stuff. Every word goes back and back and back and back, and its meaning may have changed, but these noises that you and I just making at each other, that's being electronically transmitted between us, but nonetheless, how come these noises mean things? How come this fairly narrow band of sounds that our vocal cords and tongues and lips and teeth are busy at work on can represent quite abstract, complex thoughts? It's that how come has come to fascinate me, and it isn't just spoken word. Spoken words, what I say, is equally true for written words as well. So it's a growing hobby that is threatening to turn into an obsession.
Okay. Going back to your Americanisms that you're noting down, I noticed that in Cloud Atlas, two of your voices are in fact American, and I'm wondering if you harbor a particular sort of, I know this is really a really bad question coming from an American, but do you harbor a particular sort of fascination with America? Why would you explain that two of the voices ended up being American?
Brits don't deserve our luck in sharing the same linguistic gene pool as Americans. And Australians too. I'm really impatient with purist British English apologists who regard Americanisms and Australianisms as somehow corrosive. They are wonderful and rich and language broadening and therefore concept broadening. I start from a standpoint of admiration. It was possibly a little bit arrogant of me to think I could do a whole cast of American 1975 of American characters sort of off pat, which is perhaps why I put that story in both in the third person and in a fictitious American city. It's never really existed, so somehow a little bit like Nabokov's American characters in Ada and Arda. It doesn't really matter if it's a quarter tone out, because kind of the world, the America that I'm doing is also a quarter tone out. Adam Ewing, the earlier American character, was in some ways a bit easier, because I could use someone like Melville as a model and just make him a little bit less prone to prolixity. And anyway, of course, America was a much younger country and American English was a younger entity back in the 1850s. So in a sense, it was closer to British English then. So that was a little bit easier to do. But I have two characters speaking American English because of the fact that I respect American English and wish to incorporate it and emulate it in the same way that 19th century American writers did with British English.
Gotcha. I was curious, are you aware of literary blogs?
Literary blocks?
Yes. There's a whole world on the internet, and in fact, there's actually been a lot of discussion going on about Cloud Atlas. Have you heard of a blog before?
This is a new one on me, Edward. Could you spell the word for me, please?
Oh, it's blog. B-L-O-G.
Okay.
It's short for weblog.
Okay.
And there are actually these sites that are available that chronicle the latest literary trends. I actually have a literary blog of my own if you go to edrance.com, but there's actually a number of them. There's maudnewton.com, there's the Elegant Variation, elegver.com, but there are all of these literary blogs out there, and in fact, there has been an incredible amount of discussion going on about the Cloud Atlas, and in fact, there a lot of people I know, myself included, actually obtained your book from the UK before it even was published here in the United States. And because of all of the excitement about it, you should really check these out because there's a lot of people who are interpreting your book.
What you call a blog, I may have called a chat room in the past. I will have another look with renewed interest. And could you give me the name of yours again?
Oh, yeah. Mine is Edrance, EDRANTS.com.
EDRANTS.com. EDRANTX or Z?
TS. It's short for Ed Rance.
Okay.
Yeah.
.com. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. But you should but if you also go to the Elegant Variation, there was a lot of discussion going on. What these sites are? They basically report book coverage. And these foster sort of further discussion because it's very easy to sort of post a piece of news through these. I'm actually surprised because there's really been a lot of talk about you, Mr. Mitchell.
Well, was it Oscar Wilde who said, if there's one thing worse than being talked about, it's not being talked about?
Yes.
I'm really happy that people have thought strongly enough about my work, whether for good or ill, to spend time doing it, and it's just one of the fabulous uses that the internet can be put to.
Well, one thing too is that there was actually pretty much the consensus was, what's this stuff about difficult or unreadable? We enjoyed the hell out of your book, you know.
well, in that case, I'm especially pleased that it's being talked about.
But anyway, going back to some. Back to the questions. I also wanted to go back into some of the references to the act of writing that are actually in Cloud Atlas. You have Timothy Cavendish complaining of tricksy devices, and even Elgar shows up and he confesses that he composes for the money. I just was curious. Are these responses to possibly sort of a greater quest about sort of the act of writing or the act of art within your sort of this immense trajectory that dares to sort of plot human development?
Yes, a couple of things I want to say in response to that. One is, of course, each of the novellas is a different narrative form, is a different, if you like, a different mode of storytelling from the journal letters, the epistolary form, the modern pulp airport novel, Cavendish is both a memoir and in the Son Me section it's a film, although I don't really discuss the film very much. Then there's an interview, the narrative possibilities of just the dialogue. I'm not putting on ancient Greek airs here, but it's interesting that the Greek philosophers tended to use the form of dialogue not as a radio play, but as a means of inquiry. The Sluice's Crossing section is the oldest one of all, and probably the last one of all as well, that of the yarn, just the spoken vernacular. So that's sort of one of that's kind of the hidden architecture of Cloud Atlas. Now, the other thing you said, all writers naturally, we're fascinated by writing, because it's at the core of our vocation. Where does this need come from? How is it that different writers do it in different ways? What are the risks involved in sort of externalizing in externalizing the interior? What are the obstacles involved in doing that? These are fascinating questions, and I kind of have a theory, you know, when writers write about other artists, non-writers, I mean, artists or musicians or architects or any practitioner of the other arts, I kind of think that usually, whether they know it or not, they're writing about writing. There is a sort of taboo, at least in the UK. I've got a friend who had written a character who was a writer, and at a festival where he did a reading, a discourteous member of the audience said, "Isn't a writer writing about writing basically literary masturbation?" And although that kind of question doesn't really need an answer, it does, I think, give a vulgar voice to a feeling out there that writers that it is somehow an overly navel-gazing thing to do, to write about writing, even though visual artists can do self-portraits, for example. I'm thinking of Rembrandt's deeply psychological portraits of himself, of an artist, or
even David Markson, for example.
I respect you too much to not hide my ignorance.
Oh,
sure. The artistic canon is full of artists whose main theme is art, and even in music, I could think of something like Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. In a way, all music is about music as well. That's almost a non-starter. But somehow it's not okay for writers to write about writing.
Well, I think I could help you here. My colleague Mark Sarvis suggested that of all the sequences in the book, the Forbisher sequences don't really involve a do-gooder against larger corrupt forces. But personally, I think I'd argue that actually it's sort of Forbisher's struggles as an artist, which is sort of like a more kind of subtle kind of expose about artistic integrity. So in the way you're actually writing about writing and writing about art, but you're not necessarily doing it in a way that's completely obvious. It's sort of like kind of hidden. And in fact, the nature of Frobisher's fate, which I won't reveal to people who may not have read the book, but basically it sort of suggests that there's this battle for art that kind of goes back to the caveman paintings, and it's this deep-seated struggle of sentiment and of emotions. It's something that kind of Adam Ewing expresses at the end of the book. You know, what you called the stroke of a president's pen. Do you think these are the things that kind of can set back art? Are these, is this kind of perhaps getting sort of in the territory that you were getting at here? Or?
Yes, what you said makes complete sense to me, and I think you said it rather more eloquently than I could myself.
Oh, jeez.
I think I might buy into this taboo on writers writing about writing myself, and this is, in fact, this is why I brought up the subject. I think, when I... Frobisher is many things, but he is an artist of integrity, and his mode of death proves that, I think. And I do use him and Elgar and Vivien Ayres as ways for this writer to examine writing. Yeah, the stuff about strokes, the stroke of a myopic president's pen. It's I think I was perhaps talking in more humanistic terms there, just about how one act of macho posturing on behalf of a politician for a cheap block of votes can.
I wouldn't know anything about that in this country.
Far be it for a foreigner to suggest any such thing that it's really that I had George Bush in mind. Good God, no, not me. Although I suppose I was talking just about humanism there. I think art is sort of where the human soul sings to itself, or writes to itself, or sketches itself. So, humanism and the soul are in some way sort of suffused with each other.
Actually, maybe this might... I also kind of want to just keep on rolling on this, but... I wanted to quote Louisa Ray's appearance in Ghostwritten, actually, where she says, you know, and you're familiar with this more than I am, but she says the human world is made of stories, not people. The people the stories use to tell themselves are not to be blamed. Do you think that you see humanism within the context of these stories, between the stories you tell, the stories we all encounter?
That's a beautiful thought. I'd completely forgotten that Louisa Ray said that. That's a good line. I just need a little bit of help. Could you say the question in slightly different terms? I'm having a problem getting a handle on it.
I guess what I was trying to sort of get at here is, do you think... it sort of ties into what I actually wanted to ask you a question about sort of politics and literature, but I think it also has to do with something similar in terms of humanism in literature, or humanism in art. And... I guess what I'm trying to say is that in telling your stories and getting at these particular themes, you know, are we blaming ourselves? You know, are these a way of sort of, I guess, not necessarily therapy, but sort of a way of kind of getting at the deeper meaning of the world? I'm getting into generalizations here, so I think we both need to help each other out. But something along those lines.
Now I'm completely with you, Edward. Yeah, it's more a broad observation than a question, but sure. I view fiction as a semi-autonomous enclave in society. It's a place where ideas can jam with impunity, and it's a place where the imagination can manifest itself without being accused of childishness, or without being ridiculed as sort of being the opposite of progress with a capital P and purpose with a capital P. But it's nonetheless sort of the enclave of society that makes life tolerable. And it's where the creativity that actually shapes the rest of society. I'm not giving myself airs and graces here, and I'm not saying I'm this sort of me and other writers are fantastically important people because our nurses and doctors and gardeners and any vocation that they're all equally important. But I am saying that this fiction is the importance of fiction cannot be understated, both as therapy, as you suggested, and I kind of was trying to get at the same thing by saying that
affirmation, perhaps.
Sure. It's we read, and possibly I write, because when you're a lonely kid and the world's quite an intimidating place, a book is this world you can go into, and everything that you're afraid of and that you can't handle, and this incidentally is why it's really good to get kids reading when they're young, everything you're afraid of and you can't handle is outside the confines of the book jacket. They're outside the covers of the book, and this fundamental human need for stories, both to hear them and to tell them, is fulfilled within this enclave, within the book, within this part of human existence called fiction. Its name changes through the ages, and I guess accidentally this is sort of something Cloud Atlas shows as well, that what fiction is doesn't always have the name fiction, but it's always the same stuff, and it's deep, deep, deep in the core of what humanity is. We need stories, they're good for us, and we are screwed up without them. I can even wheel out the F word, we are fucked up without stories. We need them.
Yeah. Okay, well, I know that we're running low on time, but I did want to actually close with one sort of question that is, I think, very important. But anyway, Sean Walsh at the L&R Books Diary has said of the cover of the UK edition for Cloud Atlas, he says, "The saddest story I know, one of the finest authors of his generation writes a book that truly establishes him, puts him up there. He goes to his publisher, drops off the manuscript, but while sauntering out the door, probably pretty fucking pleased with himself, he makes his one mistake. He's forgotten to say no maroon." Did you have any influence over the cover, or would you care to respond to that?
Bless him. That's funny. With my publishers, I've got a president. I have first stage input, and I have a final stage presidential veto. It's that. So my input was that I didn't want it to look like a book. What's the name of the Windows program that does
PowerPoint? Or
there's another. Windows software has made many book covers, at least in the UK, quite generic. It's usually a doctored photograph with blurry bits.
Oh, I know what you mean. It's sort of like a problem in typography altogether, where you have like an image with some sort of snazzy font, and that's pretty much all book covers, you know?
Exactly. My initial input was I didn't want it to look like a book. The art director's response was to get a couple of artists who've only done a ambient house music artwork. So artwork for posters, for CD sleeves and advertising music. And it's the first book they'd ever been asked to do, and because they're really excited about it. It's just a case of personal preference, I think. I absolutely love the UK hardback edition. I'm not quite so keen on the paperback that's coming out, but kind of that was a bit of a fait accompli before I knew what was what.
What, one thing, though, why did this book only come out in paperback here in the States? I was actually quite surprised. I have actually the UK hardcover sitting right here, but I'm just wondering why that decision was made.
Random House wanted to try it out. Often in the UK, books are published as paperback originals, or what the UK market calls trade paperbacks, and they skip the hardback altogether. For a while, people at Random House have sort of wanted to see what would happen if they tried the same approach with a book over here, where they skip the hardback altogether. The logic being that the book is at its least affordable when it is most visible in the media and in the bookshops and when it's still news. And so they wanted to see what would happen if they could combine the publicity with the book at a more affordable price. Mine was sort of chosen because my editor thinks, just sort of had a feeling that quite a few of my writers are, quite a few of my readers tend to be younger, therefore with less money, and kind of it would sort of hurt them more to try and find $25 for a hardback, whereas it hurts them a lot less to find $12 for a paperback. I was asked if I didn't mind, and I could have kicked up a fuss and said no, but I don't know a thing about publishing in the States, and my publishers do, so I said sure, and it's worked. At least in terms of sales figures, it's worked.
Okay. Well, Mr. Mitchell, I know that we're over the time, but I want to thank you very much for this interview, and I wish you best of luck, and I'll definitely be looking forward to the fourth one.
Well, if we ever get the chance to meet, then please call me David rather than Mr. Mitchell.
Cause oh, sorry.
My accountant. It's fine. No, it's been my pleasure speaking with you, Edward, and thanks ever so much for having read the book so attentively, and for generating such an interesting interview that I've enjoyed too, which also isn't completely normal.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Mr. David.
My best wishes to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.